we are going to get started in just a few minutes. And some of you may have been here on Friday when Audrey Yu spoke just after her her debate with Donald Tsang, and she set a precedent. She did her talk sitting down, and today's speaker, Simon Yeung, has also decided he'd like to do it sitting down. Very glad to have Simon at the club today. Simon was born in Hong Kong but moved to Canada at a very young age and was raised there. And after doing his law education, did work for the it was the Attorney General's office in Ontario. However, I think Simon has a secret wish to be a journalist, because he said he really always wanted to write and publish, and that was one of the reasons for coming back to Hong Kong and joining the university faculty, where he has, of course, established himself as one of the leading experts on political reform and basic law issues. And has just come out with a very timely book published in cooperation with Civic Exchange, co-written by his colleague Richard Cullen at the university.
You were before.
Not getting any sound now.
It certainly is the right book at the right time. The situation is very, very fast moving. Simon started to write it in 2007 and said he was, you know, he was revising it as he was writing it, and then here it is. He comes out, and there's a compromise over the weekend, which is changing the situation. In fact, there was a press conference at 12:15 today at central government offices where Donald Tsang was speaking, and basically, I believe, to confirm the details of what was leaked at the weekend. I wasn't there, but the New York Times was there, so Keith Bradshaw can maybe fill us in and ask a question later. So we look forward to Simon's talk. Simon, thanks for coming to the FCC.
Something low level.
Thank you very much, Tom. And what an honor to be here launching the book on this historic day. Let me just first begin by mentioning that my partner in crime, Richard Cullen, very much wanted to be here today, but unfortunately is still in Melbourne. I also then want to begin with a few thank yous. Firstly, of course, I want to thank Christine Lowe and Civic Exchange and Yen Yen Yip, who I see is here today, because without them, this project would not have taken off the ground. And this is actually part two with our collaborations with them.
We haven't
worked with them on the functional constituencies, and now on we've finished this project on the chief executive. Also, I want to thank Hong Kong University Press. You'll see, anyone who's had a look at the book yet, in the book we actually thought that all this business about political reform would have been over and done with by the time we published this book, but speedy Hong Kong University Press was able to get the book out almost a month before the actual vote. I also want to thank my researchers, and they're all mentioned in the acknowledgement, so if there's any errors in the book at all, blame them. I'm also very pleased to see that one of the researchers is here today, Angela Lodge. She did excellent work on our chapter and on the appendices. And finally, of course, I want to thank Donald Tsang, because his office, they have given us the consent to use his ballroom for the cover of our book. So let me then move on to the presentation. And I only just want to give an overview of the book and also some of my thoughts on what's currently happening right now.
Listen here.
And it's very good to be talking in this political climate, because I don't need to go into all the detail, the facts and background, because I think it's on the edge of everyone's minds. So let me just go straight to what I would say the three major findings in our book. Now, don't hold your breath. This is not Nobel Prize discoveries. The first finding that we say is that the election committee, this 800-member body that we use to nominate and elect the chief executive, is going to be around for some time, even after universal suffrage. There seems to be this repeated statement that it's going to be transformed into this nominating. Also, also in chapter 3 of the book, we talk about the significance of the election committee for China in returning Hong Kong's deputies to the National People's Congress. It's been doing that since 1997. So that is something that China sees as being valuable for helping them to find their legislators who are from Hong Kong. So that's going to continue as well. So our position is really that we can't just ignore the election committee, we can't just dismiss it, we have to study it for purposes of reform. And so that's our starting point in this study. The second major finding is that many of the principles of reform, we often talk about what are the principles that should govern reform, well, they are found within the basic law itself. You don't have to go very far. They're all there. Article 45 talks about a broadly representative election committee after we have universal suffrage, elected by democratic procedures. Nominations by democratic procedures. Even in Annex 1, there are principles like broadly representative. So our election committee is supposed to be broadly representative. Principles of democracy are found in Annex 1. Principles of openness. And what are the principles of democracy? Well, we would say that you have to look at the Bill of Rights, Article 21 in particular. Article 21 tells us about the right to vote, the right to take part in public affairs, and also the right to be elected by equal universal suffrage, and also elections that guarantee the free expression of the will of the electorate. That's all in the basic law. You don't have to go very far beyond it. And so we found in our study that most of these principles are in breach under the current system. And hence, very interestingly, when Mr. Chow Xiaoyang on June 7th, when he was giving his statement, something that maybe not have been picked up upon in the press because many were maybe thinking about the Legislative Council, but there was a part of his presentation where he said that when it comes to the future system of nominations for the chief executive, he said that the system is going to be entirely different from the system that we have now. And to some extent, I would agree with him. And that is because we would say that the current system is not broadly representative and does not follow democratic procedures. So there would have to be change to the election committee system. Our third major finding is that the election committee currently enjoys very low public confidence and public support. We come to this finding not by reference to any opinion poll surveys, we didn't do any opinion poll surveys, but simply by reference to the facts, the data that the government provides on how many of the seats are uncontested in the election committee, and what is the voter turnout rate for these elections when they are conducted, right? And when it comes to the seats that are uncontested, an extraordinary number. In 2000, 27% of all the seats were uncontested, so over a quarter. 2006, it gets worse, it's 36%. Right? Incidentally, not as bad as the functional constituencies, which in 2008, about 47% of the seats were uncontested. Now let's turn to voter turnout rates. And people will recall how the government made comments about the Democrats' referendum by elections, saying that it had very low voter turnout rates. I think it was something in the area of 17%, drawing the conclusion that the public did not support these by-elections. Well, equally, the same statement could be said about election committees. The elections in 2000 were 19% voter turnout rate. 2006, 27%. The lowest of any form of elections in Hong Kong, including district councils. But what's very interesting is one of the features about the election committee is that it is primarily based on the functional constituencies. They're almost replicated, almost exactly in detail. It's not exclusively functional constituencies, but a good part of how we decide who the 800 members are, it's all based on functional constituencies. And so one of the things that we did in our studies, we said, well, let's look at the voter turnout rate for functional constituency elections. And let's put that up against, side by side against the voter turnout rate for election committee. And in fact, you'll find that in Appendix 20 in the book. And what we found is the same group of electors, right? But the voter turnout rates for the election committee subsectors are extraordinarily low. Often half as high as the functional constituency voter turnout rates. And what's the explanation for that? I mean, it's the same group of voters. And so when it comes to functional constituencies, they actually, the voter turnout rate is not bad. It's fairly high. And they take it fairly seriously. But when it comes to the election committee, they don't take it seriously at all. And what the inference that we draw from that is that there's very low public confidence and interest in the election committee. And I think these reforms for 2012 aren't going to change that at all. This has some very important ramifications for when we have universal suffrage. So that then brings me to the so-called four contradictions that we have in our system. This basically ties in with our conclusion, or the point that we want to make, the argument that we want to make, is that universal suffrage for the chief executive is not simply about taking those 800 votes that the election committee currently has and giving them to the people. That's not enough. That's not enough because of these contradictions. We don't go as far as Yash Guy, who very kindly wrote the foreword in our book. Professor Guy would go as far as saying that we should disband with the election committee altogether. Why have that as a restraint on who can be your chief executive? We don't go that far because the basic law says you have to have a nominating committee of some shape or form. But we do find that there are problems with the so-called contradictions. The first one being universal, but without any choice. And there's all this attention on the nomination threshold. Yes, that's important, right? But that's not going to completely address the problem here. If you can have a fairly reasonable nomination threshold, yes, we maybe can have more than one candidate as we did in 2007, that's fine, but I mean, are the candidates going to be sufficiently reflective of the will of the electorate? You may have three or four candidates, but if the people don't want to elect any one of them, you've got a problem. You don't have a system that guarantees the free expression of the will of the electors. And so we have to have reform here. It's not only about the nomination threshold, but it's also about the composition of the election committee. Right? We may have 1,200. Right? But what is the makeup? Where do they come from? Where do the election committee members come from? Who gets to be involved in electing them or selecting them? Right now, the constituency size is only 230,000 individuals and companies. I think in this recent debate that's occurred, there really hasn't been any adequate explanation from the government as to why they've backtracked on the proposal. Remember in 2005, the proposal was to add all of the district council members to the election committee.
All 500.
They backtracked. Now it's only 175 actually. 400 members, 100 to each subsector, 75 of district councillors to the last one. Right? Why have they done that? And go through the reports and the public statement, there's no adequate explanation at all. That comes. The other point I would make here is we're all talking about the Democratic Party breakthrough, but it only applies to the legislature. Has anyone thought about applying it to the election committee? Now just think about that for a moment. We're adding 75 more district council members to the fourth sector. That'll bring it to about 117 district councilor members in the election committee. But the proposal on the table is that it's the 400 elected district councilors amongst themselves. 1 in 4 will get to be a member of the election committee. Why not widen it up to the full electorate under the Democratic Party proposal? Because I haven't heard any discussion of that at all. The Democratic Party itself has not put that forward. But why not? That would, in my opinion, give rise to possibly greater diversity or definitely more public participation in the election committee system. The second contradiction is universal suffrage but inequality. I think now, even with Mr. Chow's statement, it's now universal. That universal means universal and equal, necessarily implies equality. And the problems that we identify with the existing system, firstly, are with corporate voting. Corporate voting takes place primarily in the first sector, but it's very, very prevalent in choosing who the 800 members are. And we've written about it. In fact, Audrey Yu has made it very visible in her presentation on television about the abuses and problems of corporate vote. How through corporate structures you can have multiple votes, and there's nothing on the tables now to try to either eliminate corporate voting or to reduce the incidences of abuse. So that's a very serious problem. But one of the interesting things about the election committee when compared to the functional constituencies is that corporate voting is primarily confined to the first sector. Right? What does that mean? Well, the first sector only results in 200 seats. So under the election committee system, because of this so-called balance, you're able to sort of confine this evil of corporate voting into just the first sector. So whatever abuses they are subject to, their influence is only confined to one quarter of all the representatives on the election committee. Whereas on the functional constituencies, corporate voting exists in almost more than half of the FC constituencies. And they give rise to significant problems. The second issue about equality is, well, how do you achieve equality? And what do we mean by equality? And this is kind of an interesting issue. Because equality can mean one of two things. And I think in the book, we liken this to in the US, the way you elect the US representatives, the House of Representatives, and the way you elect people to the US Senate. And I think, as most people know, that voting for the members of the House of Representatives is based on an equality of voting power based on the size of your geographical constituency. Right? So the larger your geographical constituency is, the more representatives you should have. Right? But when it comes to, not always the case, but that's the theory. But when it comes to the Senate, right, it's two representatives from every state, regardless of whatever size your state is. So there's what I would call an equality of interests. Every state is of equal interest. So similarly, that same way of thinking of equality applies to the election committee. Right? Do we want a system that approximates the number of representatives to the number of people in your constituency? Right? Or do you want a system where we say that all interests are equal, the number of representatives that we allocate to each subsector should be the same. Okay? That's what I would say the two possibilities for thinking about equality. Unfortunately, the current system fails on both fronts. Right? In fact, we have an appendix in the book where, well, what if we follow the first equality? If we allocate seats to the subsectors based simply on the size of your election committee, how many members do you have? And it would look completely different from what we have now. For example, in a catering, we get something like 40 seats. Currently, it has something like, I believe it's 12 seats, etc., etc. So that's one way of trying to adhere to equality. But the other way, and I think there are arguments that we can use to support the equality of interests approach, but that also fails. Because while you have equality between the four sectors, 200, 200, 200, 200, that's fine, but there's no equality between the number of seats for the subsectors within each sector. Okay? And this is why we get this gross anomaly of the agriculture and fisheries subsector, which is in the third sector, it has 41 seats. Right? Whereas catering and others in the first sector, financial, they have 11 seats. There's no rhyme or reason for this allocation at all. The reason why we get this is because of this anomaly that they've said that, well, we're going to allocate within each sector an equal number of seats to each subsector, within each sector. Right? But they've forgotten about the other subsectors and the other sectors. Right? And so there's no attempt at all in achieving an overall equality of interest amongst all subsectors. And no explanation for why that is. Serious problems with equality that requires some comprehensive and overall thinking about the design, or I should say the redesign, of the system. That then leads me to the third contradiction, which is that of being universal but exclusive, because the system as we found it is extremely exclusive. There's been very little change on how you can get into the system to vote, how you can get recognized as an interest to have voting power in the election committee. It's very closed. It's a closed system. For example, you know, I may be a member of a profession, because as you know, in the basic law, it says the professions get 200 seats. It doesn't enumerate what professions, it just says the professions. Well, I may be a veterinarian. Is that a profession? I hope so. Right? I would want to vote in this system. I should come under the second sector. Maybe I might not get as many representatives as the medical or the health services subsector, but I should have a seat. Right? But current system excludes veterinarians and many other people who may think they have a profession. That's fine, okay, that may have been how it was when we designed it initially, but how do you get into the system? Maybe you would think that maybe there should be some way for you to apply, maybe I should be a recognized profession. But as it is now, there's no system at all for applying, there's no criteria for defining what are the professions I get into get into the second sector, right? So the recognition of interest is very problematic. It's extremely closed, and there's no way of actually getting inside the system. And then, of course, what if I'm a recognized sector? Say, for example, financial services, and I work in the financial services industry. I want to get a vote in the system. Again, there's no way, no easy way. The way that works right now is it works, by the way, by reference to what are called umbrella organizations, right? And if you are an umbrella organization that's recognized by the system, then all the members, the voting members of that organization, will be entitled to vote. Okay? Well, how do you decide what umbrella organization gets recognized? Again, there's no rules that govern the recognition of umbrella organizations. Right? And again, the government exerts very little control over, or monitoring over the members of the organizations who are entitled to vote. It's all really left to the umbrella organizations to decide. Right? So the problems of exclusivity is another contradiction in the system. And what we argue for is that there should be some, at least organic growth, if not major expansive growth, that really opens it up to the people. So what we would recommend is that whatever happens for 2012, there needs to be a follow-up exercise that really looks at the details of the system and gets people involved in talking about what interests should be recognized, what professions, what sectors of the economy, what umbrella organizations, what are the rules, what are the criteria for joining, and if the government fails in applying those rules, then you can bring judicial review in the courts. Right? But none of that is possible right now. And so these are things that have to be done in addition to nomination threshold. And then this brings me finally to the fourth contradiction, which is universal without political parties. And of course, I'm making reference to the rule that we have now that prohibits the chief executive from being a member of a political party. Right? We all know that this is problematic. And of course, many of you will know that this is not a requirement of the basic law. This is something that's spelt out in our local legislation. One of the things that we try to do in our project is to try to trace the origins of this rule. Where did it come from? And why do we continue to insist upon having it? Well, I think one of the earliest origins of the rule, if not the origin, seems to be in 1996, when the preparatory committee, remember the preparatory committee is responsible for selecting the first selection committee, 400 member selection committee, and also for selecting the provisional legislative council. Well, this preparatory committee had to design rules for electing the very first chief executive. And one of the rules that a working group came up with was to say, well, this person can't be a member of, you know, a political party. Why? It gave two primary reasons. The first reason was that, well, the chief executive for Hong Kong has to act in the interests of the overall public. That's fine. We can accept that. I think we can all agree with that. Then the next statement is controversial. They say, but if a chief executive was to come from a political party, right, it would make it very difficult for this chief executive to act in the overall interests of the public. And I think that raises serious questions. Is that really true? Is a member of a political party, at least in today's climate, unable to act in the overall interest as well? Well, the second concern they had was a bit more specific. They said, well, if a chief executive is a member of the political party, and that chief executive would have to adhere to the rules and policies of that party, and hence might tend to be more in bias or in favor of that political party. Okay, there could be some serious concerns there, but why don't we leave it to anti-corruption laws or bribery laws to deal with this? Why should we, across the board, preclude the chief executive from being a member of a political party? And I think just recently, in these, last month or so, we've just seen how very important political parties are, both from the perspective of, you know, Hong Kong and also China, to the development to constitutional reform and the development of our political system. So it just doesn't make sense at all. And we had thought in the book that maybe they might use this as a way for bargaining, but unfortunately we were really left with very little direction from the government on the future of this restriction. I think I better wrap it up here. It's a very short book, actually, so if I say too much, I may give away the ending. Another reason, of course, to buy the book is that all the royalties go to Civic Exchange. Thank you very much for attending today, and I'd be very happy to answer your questions.
Simon, thank you very much for that very comprehensive and interesting tour of the election committee. Throw it straight open to the floor. Please do identify yourself when you ask a question. If you're seated somewhere where you can't catch my eyes so easily, just let the staff know. Are there any questions from the floor straight off? Let me begin. Simon, I realize the election committee has many sins, but doesn't the fact that, nevertheless, it still threw up a pro-democratic candidate at the last round, frankly, excuse a lot of them? And just in addition to that, there's a lot of cynicism, especially in the pro-democracy camp, that the whole point of increasing the size of the election committee is somehow to make that impossible to happen again. I know Alan Lee Pung-Fei says he's done the math on this, and it would be a lot harder under a 1,200-member election committee get someone like Alan Mullen. What are your views for the
speakers? Yes, the book highlights this reality it as a positive. The reality that in 2007 we were able to come up with two very different candidates, and so that's actually a good thing about the existing system. But reflecting upon it, in the book and also since publishing the book, I mean, one has to put that in a proper context, in that, there was a very different feeling at that time about the possibility of what the election committee could do, if really put, where Democrats sort of game the system. And I think that's what happened, is that there was an enormous amount of effort to try to get those 130 or so nominations, but extraordinary amount of effort to do that, not easily achievable. And then
you know, what about a third candidate? What about a fourth candidate? I don't think the existing system really allows for that. And so it is very inflexible. Another good thing that we had identified about, it's really a commentary not about the election committee, but about Hong Kong, is how we were able to have the public debate and the television debates and the very, you know, the live atmosphere that you find in a democracy. And we think that's very positive. So these are all, you know, good things. But at the same time, it also, I think, you know, does raise my hope that we can, I'm not talking about a much larger election committee, but I am talking about having an election committee that's redesigned in a way that reflects the will of the electorate and not just, you know, certain views in the community.
Thank you. David.
David O'Rear from the General Chamber of Commerce, which is one of those functional constituencies, although I'm not allowed to vote in it. In other systems that I'm aware of, once you reach the threshold necessary for a nomination, even if it's first and then seconded, that's it, it's done. So wouldn't the simplest solution be to have a cap, that if you need 130 nominations, once you get to that point, it's done? So you cannot capture enough nominations to eliminate the possibility of others? It seems like such a simple solution.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That's one of our recommendations in Logan Beth. What's interesting is that this is not a new idea. If you go back to 1996, that's how the system worked. In 1996, when we elected the first chief executive, it was actually a three-stage process. The first stage was anyone could submit an application to be the chief executive. And all you had to meet was the bare minimum requirements of eligibility. Right? At the second stage, the selection committee met. They heard presentations from, they didn't hear presentations yet, but they met to nominate. And the nominate was done entirely by secret ballot. Whereas under this current system now, we all know who nominates who. Now it's done by a secret ballot. And then at the third stage, you sort of decide then which of the candidates who applied were able to get the threshold. And then they go on to the third stage of the actual election. And then there were presentations that were done. So it's not exactly the same, David, as what you're suggesting, but I think it's a much better improvement to what we have now, where I agree with you, it is a current problem with the system.
Francis.
Francis Boyer, RTHK. Just an observation, question. The observation is, I'm not sure why you would want to spend a lot of time trying to think ways of making functional constituencies improved if at the end of the day what you want to do is get rid of them. Mm. The other point is, today the chief executive has announced that the government is accepting what is essentially the Democratic Party's plan for the election of five seats from district councils, nominated by the district councils and voted upon by the general population. Do you view this as first of all, what is your view of this proposal and its acceptance? And secondly, do you see it as a possible model for university inequality in the future, as it was originally put forward by the Liberal Party for the year 2020?
On the first question, why reform FCs if we want to abolish them, my simple response is everything I said today doesn't necessarily mean we have to do the same for the Legislative Council. And I think the point that I began with today is that the reality is that the election committee is likely to be here for a long time. In 2017, it'll probably be called a nominating committee, but I think the essence of it will be very similar to what we have now, unless we can reform it. And that's what our hope is in the book. Doesn't necessarily mean the same thing for functional constituencies for the legislature. The second question then is about this breakthrough and the implications of the breakthrough for universal suffrage. Well, if it's a question about what I think about the Legislative Council, then, you know, is it a model for universal suffrage for the Legislative Council in the future? I would say it's probably not. I think I've said in the past that we need to abolish the existing functional constituencies. So the existing proposal that is now being tendered, I think, only gets it partially right. I mean, it's widening the electorate, right? But of course, we need to do something about the existing functional constituencies. But as I've tried to say in the presentation today, what about the implications of the Democratic Party's proposal for the election committee? Now, this hasn't been explored at all. And I think it's definitely an option that can be used to widen the scope of public participation in the election committee, and hopefully could give the election committee some greater credibility.
Is there a question from the floor before I turn over to Keith for the last question? But we can certainly take another from the floor. Keith, why don't you go ahead?
Donald Chung was specifically endorsing today a principle we hadn't heard as much about since the British days, which was, he said, he was endorsing one person, two votes. Isn't there some way to use that principle in the context of the election committee as well, in order to broaden the suffrage for this election of whether it's 800 or 1200? Hasn't there now been a precedent established that even though they are so-called functional constituencies, you're going to have 3 million voters for them? Isn't there a way to carry that over into the election committee's election process?
Absolutely. I mean, that was my point. What if we take the Democratic Party's proposal, put it in the election committee? That would mean one person, one vote, actually.
It'd be,
because right now it's only 220,000 people having a vote. Absolutely. I think so. I think it's completely compatible with the basic law. When Annex 1 talks about the principles of democracy, principles of openness, when Article 45 talks about democratic procedures, broadly representative, it's completely compatible with allowing everyone to have some participation in electing the members of the election committee or nominating committee.
There is time for one more question if there's one from the floor. If not, I'll ask it. Simon, we're always in discussing Hong Kong politics. The focus is relentlessly internal on what's happening here, what it means for Hong Kong, and obviously that's the focus of your book as well. But I mean, looking at this more broadly, is there? Do you have any sense that what's happening here in Hong Kong, with slow moves towards universal suffrage, does this have any relevance to what might happen one day in China? Mm-hmm. I was very surprised to be across the border in Guangdong last week when the debate between Audrey and Donald occurred, and they didn't censor it. You could watch that on TV channels in Guangdong. Do you have any sense that there is wider relevance here, or is it something that will change Hong Kong but no other part of China?
Absolutely. In fact, what's very interesting when you read Cao Xiaoyong's statement on June 7th is basically lays down sort of the Chinese approach to political reform in Hong Kong. And one of the things that he says is that one of the important requirements is that it has to be in accordance with law. In accordance with the basic law. There's repeated reference to the basic law. And I found that very positive, because that's what I'm talking about today, that we have to go back to the basic law, because the principles are there. And so that's very positive, I think. But at the same time, you see this very strong reluctance to go too fast. And so China's not going to allow you to have democracy immediately. It's not the Chinese way. But this development now with the Democratic Party, allowing this dialogue and debate within the community, right, and then having dialogue with the central authorities, resulting in some positive development, I think that's that could have positive implications for elsewhere in China.
Thank you, Simon. Please join me in thanking Simon for a very interesting talk on this very topical subject. As always, we come up with a special gift for our guests, and we got this from the National People's Congress Standing Committee. They've issued a reinterpretation of your book. They've resolved all the contradictions, and this will be the version on sale in Hong Kong's bookstores.
Thanks.
And as always, the book, of course, is available if you want to buy a copy, and Simon will be here for a little while if you'd like to get him to sign it. Thank you.